Well, it is my great pleasure this week to have Louise Naylor. And Louise, we were just talking, you've been at the University of Kent over 30 years, is that right?
Absolutely. In fact, it's precisely 34 years, a full 34 years, and I retired just over 6 weeks ago. So I'm in a new transition to what I'd call my third life.
It's funny, isn't it, when you get appointed in a place, I'm sure we'll talk about this, and you imagine maybe a year or two ahead, but you can never think 5, 10, let alone 20 or 34 years ahead. Mm. And then, of course, you can look back after those 34 years and remember that younger self and all the hopes and dreams that were there.
Absolutely.
But you can't always do it the other way around. So that's something I think we'll have a very enriching conversation.
Yes, yes. It was certainly never the plan. And if I tell you that when I was appointed at Kent, my husband had got a job at Pfizer, I needed a job in Kent, and I was appointed to 1 year temporary lectureship and was told, do remember this is only for a year. And yet 34 years later, I was leaving the university. So it was never the plan. And I think one of the things that I say to people is my career has been one of serendipity and opportunity. At all stages, I've been open to new ideas, try to change, try to develop. And I think I've been able to do that at Kent. So that's been a real privilege.
No, that's amazing, because sometimes when you're in a job, the job can define you, but also you can define the job. And I found that, I mean, actually podcast is one way of doing it, but also just ensuring that you are always refreshing yourself, because if you feel refreshed, and I'm finding this now with my students, you know, 19 yes. years since I first came here, I'm enjoying the teaching more than ever. And I didn't necessarily expect that, because you might think, oh, there's a point where you think, oh, I've done it all now. But each student is different. Each student has bespoke needs. And suddenly you realise, gosh, there are new challenges. They're asking me questions. I have to think on the spot. So it's interesting sometimes how, contrary to what you might think, where after a long period you start to feel a little bit fatigued, it can work the other way. So between the two of us, I think we'll get this sorted as to exactly what the recipe is for lasting a long time.
And you're touching on something there that is quite interesting, because I was in biosciences for I think in total it was just over 15 years, and I remember every year revising my lecture notes, responding to student feedback, thinking, right, I've got it sorted now, you know, there's no problems are going to arise. And every year there were new issues, the students were different, the perspectives were different, the, you know, what was happening in the field had changed, so I had to update things. And it made me realise, actually, you can be prepared, but you're never fully prepared. And I think the most important thing when you're teaching is to be open-minded to new challenges. And I also think it's okay to say to students, that's a really good question that I don't know the answer to, but I'll come back to you next week. Or you can ask the class, does anybody know the answer to that? So I think that's something I learned very early on in my teaching, is preparation is important, but then you've also got to be very responsive and reactive, but in a what I would say a personable way.
I think that's really important, because sometimes we are being taught by the students, because the students will ask questions and have needs.
Absolutely.
And on Friday just gone, I was teaching a module, and it just so happened it was a Friday 4 till 6, and only one student attended. That's not normal, but for illnesses and so on. We had the full 2 hours, and it was one of the most enjoyable teaching experiences, because it was a proper dialogue. And that student would have said the same things anyway. But you then realise, of course, that if you've got a class of 30 students, it doesn't mean to say that you have 30 times more opportunity. It can often be that there are one or two students who are particularly driven and other students who are not so comfortable talking. So you can never anticipate each particular lesson.
No, absolutely. And I think it's one of the challenges when you're teaching, is how do you get everybody brought into the discussion? And certainly I've had times when, you know, I've run sessions, maybe had less students than I thought, but actually it's a richer learning experience, because you're able to explore things in more depth. You understand, you know, their perspectives, their misunderstandings. But something that you said there, often they bring something to the table which is new and different. So the best type of teaching, I think, is where the teacher is also continually learning. And it's something I find when I'm mentoring colleagues, that actually I should learn as much, you know, whether I'm being mentored or I'm mentoring others, it should be a mutual learning experience.
Absolutely. And the students would always pick up on that, because they would think, hang on a minute, this person is just telling us what we don't know.
Yeah.
Or maybe they do know or don't want to know in the way that it's being communicated. Whereas if the teacher is looking at the students in front of them or on a screen during lockdown, it kind of worked the same way. But then you think, OK, well, we've got 2 hours to fill. We have to do this in a responsible but also exciting way. Otherwise, what's the point?
Yes.
And then you realise that the students will rise to the challenge because they know that the person is there to listen and respond rather than just to didactically teach something that they've done 20 times before and maybe don't enjoy it.
And sometimes just, I think, asking students what they want to get out of a session, you know, particularly a seminar or whatever, what are the areas that they're struggling with? What are the areas they want to explore more? Because often we go in with a set idea of what we want to deliver, whether it's in a lecture or a seminar. But actually having the opportunity to create just a little bit of space to say, you know, this is what I'm going to present today, but what areas are you particularly interested in? What areas would you like me to expand on? And I do know that for some staff who are teaching, they find that quite exposing. You know, they want to be controlled. I remember once talking to a colleague at the photocopier 5 minutes before the lecture, and he said, my biggest fear is they'll ask me a question that I can't answer, or they'll ask me a question. And I said, my biggest fear is that they won't ask me a question, because then I don't know, have they been engaged? Have they been thinking about it? I said, I don't mind somebody saying, do you know, you got that equation wrong. And I go, so I do, but at least I know you're listening and you're learning. So that was quite interesting, because it made me realise I had quite a different perspective on teaching from some of my colleagues, that actually I was willing to be a little bit more open, a bit more interactive, allowed myself to be exposed, so that I was willing to say, I haven't got the answer to that yet, but we'll find the answer.
Yeah, you just made me think of something, because I do some KMTV work, including live on a Thursday, and they're a little surprised that I'm happy not to know the questions in advance. Because I think, well, if I'm going in because I'm going to talk about film, then I know you're going to ask me something on film. If my students ask me a question, they don't tell me in advance. They don't say, Chris, on Thursday, we're going to ask you this question in our lecture.
Yes.
So, but also, it means I rise to the challenge. Because if I knew and just gave a very sort of pre-prepared answer, well, who would benefit from that? I would just phone it in. In fact, there's no point in being there, really.
No, but it's the
interaction. And that is what I enjoy. The live teaching event is, in a way, like theatre. It's like television.
It is a performance, however else you look at it. And, you know, I remember when I was at the Institute of Education when I started lecturing, and we had to go and, before we had the PG Cert at Kent, talk about teaching and pedagogy. And I remember thinking, well, they're going to tell us how to do it. Well, they don't tell you how to do it, but they do say, actually, about 70%, is down to the way you deliver what you're doing. If you're passionate about your subject and you can get that across, you're 70% there. And I've never forgotten that. And that's what made me realise it is about performance. It is about people saying, I want to turn up because I know this is going to be interesting. And and I think some people like the performance aspect, some people don't like the performance aspect. And I think particularly, you know, when we've been encouraged maybe to record lectures, people are very concerned about what I would call performativity. I'm going to be assessed on the way that I presented. And that's sad in a way, because it takes away from that spontaneity of teaching, that openness to be asked questions. And I think that's not what the recording is about. The recording is an aide memoir after the event, or found that difficult, I'll rerun that bit. It's not about looking through and trying to point out errors.
Yeah, and I think that you've hit the nail on the head on that, because when you're saying something and you don't even know how you're going to end the sentence sometimes because you're thinking on the spot, And then you write it down, because what I do with the students in a seminar, whenever a point is made, whether it's something that I've said or one of the students have said, I write it down to preserve, because we're going to forget it.
Yes.
Obviously, I'm hoping the students are writing it in their own way anyway. Yes, this is as much for my benefit. And you look back afterwards and you thought, okay, I went into that session at 4 o'clock on a Friday or whatever it was. I could never have anticipated that these would be the things that would come up in the course of the next couple of hours.
Yes.
So you've got that record. But if I'd even taught an hour later or with a different group of students, the conversation would be completely different. So even, 1 year compared to another is going to be different, but even the same session for the same module in the same year. And it's that sense of liveness and performance, I think.
Absolutely. And, you're talking about the 4 o'clock slot on a Friday. I always seem to have the graveyard slots. It was always 9 o'clock on a Monday morning or later on in the day at the end of the week. And I remember I used to do a lecture on a Monday between 5 and 6, and it was metabolism. It's not the most riveting to teach, lots of structures. And one day one of my students came in and she had a Sainsbury's bag and she put it on the desk and she said, "Dad said you might like this just to have fun in this lecture." And I opened it up and it was a big bar of chocolate, which was really nice. So, I worked with her dad at the university, as it turned out. But I thought, somebody recognises that doing the 5 to 6 slot is a hard ask. So I think what I was able to do was say, look, I've got a big bar of chocolate. You can all have a piece because I'm not going to eat it all. So it was great, and it's things like that... it's so rewarding teaching when it's that two way. It's not just didactic. Yes, you've got an idea about what you want them to learn, but it's that open dialogue that is so important. And one of the things that I remember doing is people say, well, if you've got a big lecture theatre with 120 students, which I did in biosciences, how do you make things interactive? How do you get people to respond? And one of the things that I learned very early on in that course in Institute of Education was to say, OK, we've had 20 minutes now. Are there any questions? Or sometimes I would put up, maybe just a little problem question. Can you work it through? What have you learnt? Sometimes we just take a break. We literally just take a break. So we just have 5 minutes break and then we start again. So there was always that, how can you just break this up? How can you chunk it up? How do you provide opportunities for students to interact and also for them to feel relaxed, in lectures, that you're not going to single them out?
Yeah, and that's so important. When you watch films sometimes of how lectures are done, they are the best, because I've never seen a film where the person lecturing does anything that anyone has ever done at Kent or anywhere else I've ever worked. And it's funny because it's that stereotype, that archetype almost of what a lecture is, and the way a lecturer either does or doesn't know their students, or the way that they're telling the students what to think. And it's so funny because you think, this is great to watch, not as a lesson in how to do it, but in how not to do it.
Yes. And of course, we're talking today looking back. I think it's important to know that at the time you don't know whether you're getting it right or wrong. And it's often many years later, I've got a colleague now who is a reader in biosciences who was one of my students. And it's interesting because she says things to me like, I remember when you did this and I remember when you did that. And I'm thinking, I've got no recollection of that. But you don't know at the time. And I think it's really important. One of the things that we're not very good at, and I had a colleague, it's just reminding me of this conversation in biosciences when I started. They said, Louise, people won't tell you when you're getting things right, but they'll be very quick to tell you when you're getting things wrong. And I've never forgotten that, because I thought, why are people reticent to either acknowledge that was good or to provide what I would call critical but constructive feedback? I really enjoyed that, but this bit could have been better. And going back to something you said earlier, a piece of feedback I once got, I was going in to give, it wasn't a lecture, it was in the sort of education directorate or you all talking to my staff, and I wasn't really prepared for what I was going to say. And I said to a colleague, oh, I wish I'd had more time. And she said to me afterwards, she said, that was the best ever. And she said, the reason was you spoke from the heart. You knew what you needed to cover. And it wasn't rehearsed and it wasn't formulaic. It came across as very authentic. And so I've never forgotten that, because I thought, well, there's something in that, because I think like many people, I had a tendency to over-prepare, to try and have all the answers. Yeah. And I think as you get, I don't know whether it's you're older, wiser, or you find you've got less time and you're having to hit things head on. And then you suddenly think, actually, do you know, I am able to respond in the moment. I am able to think about it. And, you know, I think maybe that's part of a building of confidence. You know, you have to start and learn that actually the sky doesn't fall in if a student asks you a question that you can't answer. Or, you know, certainly when I started, a common thing, and this is aging me now, we still used overhead projectors. So, you know, I remember being in sessions and the bulb would go and I'd have to go and get the technician and he'd put the bulb in and that would take away 10 minutes and I'd think, right, or sometimes 15. Yeah. And so you have to think on your feet, what are we going to do without this? Well, do we continue? Do we stop? And I think just that, you just go back to what's the best way to react in this situation? It's not a disaster.
Actually prefer it when I'm not. Well, actually, we did have a fire drill 2 weeks in a row. I didn't appreciate that because that did take away vital time. And when something like that happens, it can be awful. But at the same time, actually, you suddenly realise that you're connecting with the students.
Absolutely.
And there's something real that's happening.
Yes.
And suddenly that notion of being in an ivory tower, the notion that suddenly you're going in as the person in full control and is going to teach and promulgate and tell them what's what for 2 hours. Ever done that.
No.
But it doesn't happen when suddenly you have to leave the room and you've got the security estate saying, get out. And it tilts the balance.
Yes, it does. And it's really interesting because you're reminding me of, you know, when we were going through COVID and I had to write some guidance about teaching in the COVID period. And the thing that I remember, and I've seen it recently because I've been sorting out my study at home and I came across it. But what it says is, remember, we're all learning. It's not just you as learners, as students. Your teachers are also learning how to teach online. So please be kind. But the thing that I thought was very interesting is the other thing that COVID did was that it broke down these barriers. We were all suddenly on a level playing field. I mean, I know there were difficulties with people getting access to equipment and so on. But what I mean in terms of teachers and learners, we were all grappling with the technology, working out how do you teach, how do you engage students. We were learning about, you know, people's environment, their home life, you know, whether you'd have people walking in during a session or whatever. But that, I think in some ways that was really helpful because we needed a bit of, you know, a bit of levity in that period. We needed a little bit of something to laugh at or have fun about, you know, the cat that walks across the desk or whatever. It just, it brought out, you've touched on something, the humanness, which is something that I feel very strongly about being human and about being authentic. And at times that can be difficult, but actually you've got to be true to yourself.
And I was thinking about this because when I was a student in the early 90s, if I even saw one of my tutors in the supermarket, it would be, they do their own shopping. You know, it somehow didn't seem back then. And you certainly, because we didn't have Facebook. But if I'd seen my tutors in the equivalent in those days, putting pictures of themselves outside the cinema, or we have a colleague, you'll know who I'm talking about, who's a pantomime dame.
Yes.
And of course, is very open about that. Mm. But, you know, in those days, it would have felt, to me at the age of 18, very odd.
Yes.
But something has changed. But it's either that somehow it's no longer seen to be strange to have that sort of levity is a good word that you just used. Or it's just the sense that the way that one sees something at the age of 50, which is I am, and the way I might have seen the world at 18 has shifted. And maybe it's part of my growth, that maybe the way that you perceive somebody, it's like a film, somebody performing. They may be great on stage, but they're not going to be Richard III forever.
No.
There's a point when the performance ends.
Yes.
And it's what you do when they're no longer playing Richard III that suddenly you realise that's where real life intersects.
And it's certainly something, you know, looking back, I mean, when I was an undergraduate student, I did chemistry at Aberdeen, and there were four females in my class and 40 males. And all of my lecturers, bar one, were male. And nobody was on first name terms. Nobody. So even the students, I was Miss Moffat at the time. Yes, and don't do the joke about Little Miss. Yes, I know that. So as soon as I got married, I said, I will take my husband's name, because I spent the first 23 years of my life with people saying, have you heard? Yes, I have. But so it went from a very formal interaction when I did my PhD in Calgary in Canada. They were much more informal. But if I tell you, even my PhD supervisor, his name was Hans van der Sand, and I found it really difficult to call him Hans. It took me about the whole 5 years of my PhD to get to a point where I felt comfortable calling him by his first name, because it had been very formal in Aberdeen. There were no first name terms. People knew first names, but you would never use a first name. So, of course, now it's very common that you do that. And, actually, people have dropped the title now, almost as it's less important.
Do you know, you've hit the nail on the head, because even now, I mean, admittedly, the people who taught me are, well, you know, retired a long time ago in many cases. But even to this day, I still feel a little uncomfortable. Maybe, actually, no, those who I've been in touch with quite a bit, and maybe like we share Christmas cards, then we know it's first name terms.
Yes, that's okay.
But even when I came to Kent, you are absolutely right. The students once asked me, they said, what do we call you? And I was a little bit thrown, because I was thinking, ooh, well, people do call me Chris, but I hadn't really worked it out.
Yes.
And even with your PhD supervisor then, did he call you Louise, even as a PhD student?
He did. So he felt comfortable to call me Louise, but I didn't feel comfortable. I got over myself and I managed to eventually just call him by his first name. But it felt uncomfortable. Felt really uncomfortable. Yeah. And in fact, you're reminding me when I first started at Kent, so my husband is also Dr. Naylor, and he did some pharmacology lectures at the university. He was working at Pfizer, and we were about halfway through the term, and some of the students came up after my lecture and they said, Dr. Naylor, so they were calling me Dr. Naylor at the time, can we ask you a personal question? And I said, well, it depends how personal it is, but yes. They said, you know the Dr. Naylor that teaches us pharmacology? Is that your husband? So I went home that evening and I said, don't expect too much from the class, because they've just worked out they were actually together, having got the same surname. So in fact, even when I started, that was quite common, that they would call you Dr. Naylor. And, you know, I suppose in lab classes and things, I would say, just call me Louise. In fact, one of my students once called me Mrs. Naylor. And I said, that's something I don't even equate to.
Yeah.
I'm either Louise or I'm Dr. Naylor. I don't think of myself as a Mrs. anything. And it was just odd. It was just odd.
And you get those. I've had those with students. Yes. Admittedly not here, but I had it maybe a few years after I got my PhD. I was a mature student who kept calling me in a class in front of all the other students, Mr. DC. Everyone else called me Chris, but he was Mr. DC. And I didn't want to call him out, because I was very comfortable with Chris. In fact, I wanted that. Or the other extreme, people would call me Professor DC. And I'm not a professor. I never have been. So they get it wrong. And I think you're right. It's either Dr. DC, but I prefer Chris. But at least that's technically correct. Otherwise, you end up with a scenario whereby it doesn't fit occasion. And then the other students pick up on it, because it's a very jarring thing that somebody's calling you. And it's maybe meant to be respectful, but it kind of works in reverse, because yes. no one else is calling you like that. Does that mean that everyone else is being disrespectful? So on that basis...
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, it can be cultural dimensions to that as well.
Or the students who now will write, "Dear Sir."
No, you see, you're really taking me back into my... Because I haven't done any formal teaching like that for quite a while, but it's amazing the memories are there. You're unlocking them for me.
Well, I'm going to ask, because you've already given away, without me needing to ask, that you did your studies at Aberdeen.
Yes.
But how did the journey start for you? So, I mean, obviously, you may not have expected to have been anything other than somebody who worked in biosciences, but your first degree was in that area. Was it in Aberdeen? Were you doing biosciences or biology?
So I went to Aberdeen to do biochemistry. And so it's a 4-year degree, and so I had done chemistry, physiology, zoology as well. And then we had to make a decision what our honours course was going to be. And I just did really well at the chemistry. And I remember having a discussion with one of my lecturers, and they said, well, if you do a degree in chemistry, you could probably do a PhD in biochemistry, you could make that switch, which is in fact what I did. I did my PhD in medical biochemistry. But if you go into biochemistry, you'll find the switch to chemistry much more difficult. So that was why I did chemistry. But actually, interestingly, going to university, you know, I did want to share this because I was thinking back. So I was first in my family to go to university. But my mum always said to me that when I was at primary school, and I was probably about 5 or 6, that she was shocked when she went to one of the parents' evenings, because the teacher said, "Louise is definitely university material." But I was only 5 or 6. And what was interesting is I know from an early age, not only did I know that I wanted to go to university, but I was very into science at that stage. Even down to naming my fish after the rare gases, neon, argon, xenon, and so on. How sad is that? So I knew I wanted to be in education, and I still have memories of talking with my friends. What would we do when we grew up? And I said, well, I'm going to be a scientist. And they say, well, when you make a great discovery, please remember we were your friends. So I was very driven, and in fact, I met somebody several years ago who, because a lot of my social life as a child was built around the church, and I met them, and they said, I just remember how driven you were. You absolutely wanted to go to university. There was no question. It evolved. I certainly didn't go to do chemistry, but I enjoyed it. And I thought, I'll do this. And in fact, I then, having done chemistry, I actually had a PhD set up at University of Cambridge. But at the time I'd met my husband at university, he was going off to Canada to do his PhD. And I thought, well, I kind of like this guy. I think I want to be with him. And so I managed also to get a PhD in the same place. And, you know, we had fabulous funding on that PhD. But I can still remember my professor of physical chemistry saying, you turned down a PhD at Cambridge. And I said, yes, but this is about my life. This is about the shape of my life. And what was very interesting, the one female lecturer that I had, Leslie Glasser was her name, and she said to me, Louise, always make the best decision you can. And then once you've made the decision, move on and never look back and never say what if. And that, I've taken that in life. I've said that to students. Make the best decision you can at the time. And that was absolutely the best decision. Absolutely the best decision for me. I don't know what it would have been like at Cambridge. I don't think I would have been a dyed-in-the-wool chemist for years, though.
I wonder sometimes that sometimes we...
It's one of these crossroads.
Yeah, but if you make the decision to do something, I find that rarely do you regret it. But if you don't take the decision to do something, that you might regret it.
Because
once you've done something, you're on a different path immediately.
Yes.
And suddenly, you were in Canada, you mentioned the funding that was perhaps different than anything you might have expected in
the UK.
And so you were on that path. Mm. But if you had stayed doing what you were doing, and maybe you were feeling unfulfilled, or you would feel that there were some gaps, you might have thought, why didn't I take that? Maybe the boat has now sailed.
Absolutely. Mm. And it's really interesting because the reason the funding was so good, we went to the University of Calgary, is that they had just discovered the oil. And there were medical research scholarships that my husband and I were on. And it was funded by oil revenue. And as PhD students, we had, I can't remember exactly the budget now, but we were able to do international travel. So I went to America, went to Israel, came back to the UK as a PhD student. And it was my own money. I didn't have to go with a begging bowl. This was something we had money to travel. It was incredible. And so, you know, we had a fantastic, absolutely fantastic time. And just as luck would have it, he was in physiology and I was in biochemistry, and our labs were next door to each other, which was just, you just couldn't make it up. And when we first arrived, he met his supervisor, I met my supervisor. And when he met his supervisor, he said, you might want to meet this. I hear there's a girl in biochemistry. She's come from the UK. Al said, yes, I'm engaged to be married. So there were just things like that. And it almost made you feel like it was meant.
Yeah.
Although I'm not somebody who believes in fate, but there are just certain things. You felt the jigsaw just came beautifully together.
That comes up so much in my interviews. Mm-hmm. And of course, I work in religious studies, and but I'm perhaps even more wary of talking about fate, because in that sense, it's something that I feel then has to be critically dissected. However, things like fate are in a different category because they're personal things that you feel and experience.
Yes.
There's no point saying, I don't believe in this, because, you know, you start doing a kind of academic treatise on that. I've had periods in my life, gone through periods where there are things that are coincidental, but they feel, well, even if they are literally just coincidental, that they empower you, they affect you in a way that isn't just a random, that happened, what's the significance of that? You feel the significance in your bones.
Yes, I would absolutely agree with you on that, because we don't. So it may be fate in hindsight, because that's how we've made sense of it. But it's, you know, we cannot control. I read a little meditation. I've got a little meditation book. It's 365 days. So you've got one for every day. But the one that always speaks to me is the only constant is change. And that recognition that actually some of the change you don't control. But what you can control is your response to that change. And therefore, it is about when things happen, sometimes good things, sometimes not good things. How do I respond to this? What can I learn from this? How can I move on from this? Because we all face, you know, positive and negative things in our lives. So I wonder if the fate aspect is a kind of post hoc analysis that allows us to make sense in a way. It's not an act. There's no purpose behind it. It's us making sense of what's happened that makes it look like fate.
Because there are many things that don't match in that way, that we don't. It's not the case that every day there's some amazing outworking of fate or magic or destiny.
Yeah.
But when those things do happen, we tend to focus on the significance of that. But on that basis, you know, why focus on the things that happen once in a blue moon that feel monumental, rather than all the day-to-day stuff when those coincidences don't happen? Because, you know, if we were having a magic moment every single day, then we probably would say, well, this is obviously kind of something powerful is at work, some mystical force is at work.
Although one thing I wanted to share with you, you know, because I knew you would ask me about books, and there's another book that I really enjoyed reading and has helped going through life, and I suppose you would say it's a kind of mindfulness now. The book is called Simple Abundance. And what it's about is, even in the mundane life, appreciate some of the great things that are going on. And what it says is, at the end of every day, think of three good things that happened that day. And you would think, well, it's got to be something monumental. But it doesn't have to be something monumental. It could be, oh, I saw my first daffodil today. Or it could be, it wasn't raining today. Or I really like, you know, we tried something new for dinner and it was great. Or we laughed at something on the telly. It is about simple abundance, that when you open your eyes, there are things you can see every day that are incredible. And one of the things I will tell you is, there's a wild orchid on the campus, and somebody knows it's there because they put a little fence around it so that the rabbits can't get to it. And it pops up every year, and it was on my way to work, and every year I've come in and I've said, there it is, it's come up again. It's a single little orchid, and I take pictures of it and I post it on Twitter and I say, here it is again. And then of course it dies away, but I always know where it is because it's got the fencing around it. And for me, that's what I call simple abundance. It's something I observe when I'm out, and it's something I notice when my husband and I love going walking. And I often think he's more of a destination person, i.e. where are we going to and how long is it going to take us to get there? Whereas I'm a journey person. What are the things I'm seeing on the journey? You know, which of course frustrates him, because I'll stop and go, oh, look at this. And, you know, so I think it's that simple abundance. And it's a really easy thing to do, because sometimes you can have had a challenging, a difficult day, maybe a sad day. And just to think, look, what happened today that was good?
And it's those.
And there is always something, you know, I saw somebody and just said hi. You know, it's always something.
And that can be the pivot around which everything else happens. And it often is at the most micro level. It can be the most ordinary of exchanges that's infused with the most extraordinary meaning. Because that person said hello, or sent you a card, or wrote you, sent you an email at that very moment when you needed that.
Yes.
And you're thinking, on some subliminal level, they knew that you needed it, and that it was perfectly timed, because it came at just the moment that you know, if they hadn't done that, your day would have been catapulted in a very different sort of way.
Absolutely.
But that, what you're saying about the simple abundance, is so helpful, together with what you're saying about journeys, because sometimes I go to the cinema a lot, and there's directly opposite where we are is the Gulbenkian. Now, you think I would just say, well, I'll just walk over there. It doesn't cost me very much. In fact, it's the cheapest way to go and see a film.
Yes.
But no, I go literally the extra mile. So I'll go to Dover, Ashford, Rochester, or maybe Canterbury. But why do I do that? And I'm fascinated at this sort of notion of, it's a form of pilgrimage almost, that it's not just a random thing. It's not just going to the cinema for the sake of it. There's a whole almost like mythology and ritual around that, because I write the reviews, I engage with people on them, I store the reviews, I reflect on them after the time, I watch films more than once.
Yes.
So that it's not just, you know, somebody else might just say, oh, well, why don't you just go home and watch it on TV? You know, why go all the way to London to watch a Hitchcock thriller when, you know, here it is on VHS. It's in the office. Just take it home with you. And I'm thinking, I have no interest in doing that. So why am I going and doing something a little bit atypical? But it's because that atypical thing is my thing.
Yes.
And somebody else might be into sport or cooking. I've got no interest in those things. So for them, you know, cooking a meal might be, you know, and they go to a lot of effort the whole day. And I'm thinking, well, once you've eaten it, it's gone.
Absolutely.
And I know there's more to it than that.
Yes.
But I would say about the film, the film stays with me forever.
Isn't that interesting? But also, I mean, I even in my walking, I'm somebody who likes to go different ways. And you know, particularly when we were in lockdown, and you could go out for an hour a day, you know, but no more than 5 kilometres from your house or whatever it was. And I used to often go out with my daughter. My husband does all the cooking, which is lovely. So we would go out at the end of the day just to get that break between the work and the evening. And I'd often say, can we just walk 2 streets back? Can we do the walk in the opposite direction? Because I find doing the same walk difficult. I do have some favourite walks, but I often want to do something different. I want to observe something different on the journey. And I was reading an article this morning, actually, before I came in. It was about walking. And I noticed that when my husband and I walk, we do talk, but we're also quite quiet. It's quite contemplative. And what this article was saying this morning is we're either looking at our phones, our computers, we're listening to music. Sometimes people are doing multiple things at one time. And that just out walking, listening to nature, to what's happening, is something we don't do very often. And, you know, you're away from traffic often when you're on a walk. We love the coastal walk. So the sound of the sea is just amazing. Just love it. And I just thought that need for calmness and peace and quiet, because I you know, the labyrinth on the campus, that was a project I was involved in 2012. And that was about creating space, quiet, an opportunity for people to use it however they want to use it. But just an opportunity to stop, reflect. I often used to go down there and have lunch. Just an opportunity. Didn't always walk it. Sometimes I would just sit on a bench, see the view of the cathedral, but just have a quiet moment in the middle of the day.
Isn't it the case, and I'm somebody who keeps it and has always kept a diary, that it's those what on the surface might appear to be prosaic, ordinary, almost trivial episodes, they're the ones that we remember decades later. You mentioned walking. Now, I used to walk to work every day. And I'd go one of two ways. But all these years on, I can't remember each walk. And sometimes if I ever do that walk again, it feels different. I suppose the walk may have changed. However, there are things that I've done once in my life, and I can remember them far more vividly, like, you know, particularly like holidays or something. You remember the room, you remember the route. I mean, maybe flawed memory, but I have a more powerful memory of something I've done once in my life than something I did every single day for years at a time.
Yes.
I find that curious. I can't. It's a paradox I can't quite make sense of.
So being a scientist, what I might say with that is that the brain responds to stimulation. And of course, we get so much stimulation in the day that we have to shut certain things off. And therefore, if we're doing things that we're familiar with, the brain is not being activated in the same way. It just becomes, you know, we're not conscious of our breathing or our heart rate normally, unless we wish to be observant. So I think it's when we're in a familiar environment, we're not challenging our brains to think differently. We're not having to navigate. We know where we're going. Everything's familiar. So it could be something like that. You know, it's like when people say, oh, did I lock the door?
Yeah.
Because they're not conscious about doing it. It's almost an automated response. And I think it's something to do with that. So that being, and it is a kind of what people call mindfulness. It's about being present. It's about not just seeing everything. And it's terribly difficult. You have to train yourself, because the most obvious thing is you wake up in the morning. Well, not so much now, Chris, but I used to wake up in the morning and think, right, I've got this and this to do, to-do list, this email, this meeting to prepare for or whatever. But actually, even when all of that clatter is going on, to just have something very simple, to just ground yourself.
And those are the things that are the authentic human bits. It's not the
big
events.
Those are the authentic human bits.
I mean, you need the graduation ceremonies.
Yes.
Those are the rites of passage.
Yes.
But often the things that people remember on the graduation day, for example, is not just going up and meeting the vice-chancellor or whoever and getting the degree. It might be the conversation with the parents of a friend
Absolutely.
That you're meeting for the first time. Or it might be the fact that, you know, you're having that coffee or something and you're in your gown. And, but it's like doing something ordinary but in an extraordinary way. So it's everyone will have their own bespoke way of remembering that. But often for
That's
a lot
right.
of people, the things they remember from their degree might be those evenings or just sitting in somebody's kitchen and chatting about something that they'd watched on TV or something unrelated to the course. But those are the things, all those decades later, those friendships that somehow take on a far bigger significance, because you think that was when I really opened up, or that's when I started to sort of see that, you know, that random conversation 30 years later has actually been pivotal in ensuring that I followed this path rather than that path.
So it's so interesting because so I started at Kent in October 89. And I remember in the first year I was there, the summer, the graduations were going on, and someone in the department had a ticket, but they weren't able to go. And so someone in the office said, oh, there's a spare ticket if anybody wants to go to the graduation. So I'd love to go. So in 1990, I went to my first graduation in the cathedral, and because it was a yellow ticket or a golden ticket, Willy Wonka style, I was up in the, you know, right up in the nave. And it was fabulous. And I remember seeing some of the students I taught graduate. And I was so proud of them. You know, you feel like a mum. I wasn't even a mum at that point. But it was such a wonderful experience. So that was my first. And it was again, serendipity. Just the opportunity arose and I took it. And I thought that's so important to see or be involved in that day of celebration when you know some of the difficulties students have gone through. So one of my students unfortunately lost her mother to cancer, and it had a very difficult year. I had another student who on his 22nd birthday said to me, oh, I'm feeling a bit depressed today. I said, why? He said, well, I'm 22. I said, well... I said, that's not, you don't need to be depressed. I said, I'm at least twice that age. In fact, what age is your mother? And he's told me his mum's age. I said, oh, she's the same age as me. And so what was interesting is when I went and was at his graduation, I said, I'd like to meet your mum. And we had a picture taken of the two of us because we were the same age. So it's just funny how these moments arise, and they are moments, but you remember them because either they were fun or they were just different. And it was about connecting with people in a way that, you know, that was one of my students. I wouldn't normally connect with them in that way.
No, and you find it's the same with welcome events, recruitment events, when you meet the parents for the first time. Uh-huh. And then, of course, you get to know their offspring, the students, well.
Yes.
But then you meet the parents again at graduation.
Uh-huh.
And then you suddenly realise how it all fits, because they'll say it was because of that open day that suddenly there's some connection. And they know that they're letting their children, you know, go off and they're comfortable. You know,
yes.
that they've witnessed the origin almost of that, of their academic journey. Mm. And then afterwards they can say, gosh, thank you very much, et cetera, et cetera. But you realise the number, and that's just, you know, that could just be one family. But think of all the multiple families who are impacted by that journey.
Absolutely. And that's the thing. When we go through our journey in life, we're working alongside people who are at different stages in their journey, depending on what they're doing at that time. And, you know, it was quite interesting because the colleague that I retired with on the same day, Malcolm Dixon, you know, we've been colleagues for over 22 years, and we met up recently just for a coffee. And it was quite interesting how we were saying we'd gone in our third age, how reflective we were being, thinking about the connections we'd made over the years, actually talking about people that we wanted to meet up with that either we hadn't had the time, you know, we'd exchanged Christmas cards, but we hadn't had time to meet up with. And I thought it was really interesting, and how you can look back at, you know, how things unfolded. There was never any plan. There's always the work that's got to be done, but sometimes there's not a plan. And it's interesting to look back and say, it's the people that you remember. It's what they brought to a particular occasion or event or project. That's what you remember. You don't remember the project in detail, or at least I don't. It's the people that were involved. It's the fun things along the way that happened. And maybe sometimes the disasters and actually the panics that you had at times about getting things done to the standard you wanted. and how you got through that, how you supported each other, you know.
And well, I found that with the diary as well, because the diary is full of all those incremental things. Like, I worked on this chapter, I worked on this thing. But you don't know the overall vision. You don't know if it's actually going to go the way you imagine it to. But looking back, you think, ah, that's how it took shape. Because sometimes, like, you don't remember the individual parts. It's like a student. They might be worried about their degree. But once they've got the degree, maybe 10, 20 years later, it's easier to forget sometimes the hardships along the way, because it's almost like, oh, yes, it all worked really well in the end. But sometimes without that journey, with all the pitfalls, all the trials and tribulations, maybe they wouldn't have got to that point. When they got to that point, you almost moved to the next level. But the journey was not straightforward. And it's easy sometimes with one's own children as well, you know, to remember that sometimes it's those circuitous journeys that make us good people.
It is. And the other thing that I've learned over time is sometimes there are challenging times, whether they're work or otherwise, but actually going through them, and in particular achieving positive outcomes, you look back and you suddenly think, how much has that experience allowed me to grow? What have I learned from that experience? You know, it might feel terribly uncomfortable at the time. And I know there's a sense now in learning that we want to make things comfortable. We want to keep people in zones where they're comfortable. I don't think that's what learning is about. I think learning is about challenging ourselves. It's about not feeling comfortable, either because you don't understand something, you need to read up more, you need to ask more questions. You might feel uncomfortable because it's you know, something to do with, you know, you're worried about being politically correct. Yeah. But actually, I think the only way that we can learn is by being open to new perspectives, new challenges. You know, I'm reading up at the moment about keeping your brain active, you know, learning a new skill. But learning a new skill is about putting yourself back in that position of not knowing how to do something. And I think that's another thing, that over the years we've become experts in certain areas. And those are our comfort zones. Those are our fur-lined ruts, as they call it. But actually, one of the challenges is to do something completely outside that. So one of the things, and I've not set it as a challenge, but, you know, when people have said, what are you going to do in your retirement? I have said, I hope in a year's time, I'm doing at least one thing that I didn't know existed, that wasn't within my comfort zone. You know, it's like you saying that you don't go to the same cinema all the time. That I'm actually doing something that is new. I'm meeting different people. It's a different sort of activity. That I've tried something where I go, okay, I tried that. I really liked it, or I absolutely hated it, but at least I tried it. So I'm hoping that at least part of that journey will be to be in a different place.
Yeah, that sameness and difference, when they're actually two sides of the same coin.
Are they?
Because sometimes you're... Like, I mean, you spent 34 years here. I've been here 19 and counting. But each year is very different. So on the surface, it's very different. But, you know, the good thing about keeping a diary is that I can prove that, because I can look back and say, what was I doing on this day in history?
Yes.
And I can think, oh, my word, did that really happen? And, you know, I forgot about that person who made this big noise and then left.
Yes.
But at the time, you think, oh, they'll be here forever, perhaps. They're making all this noise. You can't imagine them not being here. But then somebody else comes in.
Yes.
It's that kind of thing. And then you realise that you've stayed in the same place, but no 2 days are the same.
Mm-hmm.
And that is probably one of the lessons that I've learned.
Yes, it's interesting.
And there are lots of things that you can shape, but also things that you can't, and in a way don't want to shape.
No.
I mean, you know, whether it's news events, and actually the news this morning, suddenly a former prime minister coming back into the cabinet. It's things that it's like, you know, one moment, you know, suddenly you're like, okay, there is no way
Did we predict that was going to happen? Probably not.
So it's that kind of thing. But I have to ask before we start to wrap up. One thing we haven't done is talk about the origin for you. I mean, we've talked about the university origin story, but you went to Aberdeen, but am I right in thinking that you grew up in Scotland?
I did. Yeah. I did. I was born in Leith. So that's, if you've ever been to Edinburgh, Leith is where the docks are. So when I was brought up there, it was probably a little bit down at heel. You certainly didn't go to the docks after dark. But of course, now it's a beautiful part of Edinburgh. They've got the Britannia there. It's docked there. You can go on and have a look. I went to Leith Academy Primary School and then Trinity Academy Secondary. So grew up in Edinburgh. Fantastic city. I know I'm biased because I grew up there. But actually, I probably didn't appreciate how brilliant Edinburgh was until I left. It was only coming back that I think it. I mean, it really is a fabulous city. I say to people, you can walk everywhere. Train goes straight into the centre. Everything you want to see, Royal Mile, everything's walkable. It's just fantastic. People, very friendly as well. That's one of the transitions that's quite difficult when you come down south. Initially, is that people are not so open. It felt like that when I first came down. So yes, grew up in Edinburgh.
And one thing was, you mentioned October 1989 is when you started here. And the first thing that I thought of, because that's when I started my first year at A-level.
Yes.
And immediately I'm thinking, the music at the time, I remember that Ride On Time Black Box thing was number one in the chart. So that's my sort of memory of growing up with music. But do you have anything musically in that sense, or maybe filmically, or you mentioned books already? Do you sort of think, you know, when you grew up, are there particular markers? So aside from the education, because for me, if I'm driving in the car, I hear something and a particular song is so important. That's why the commute is so important, because it's not just random stuff. I can remember where I was in particular years and particular times because of what I was listening to, what I was talking about in the playground. Do you have those experiences?
So yes, and I don't mind telling you that I listen to Boom Radio for baby boomers. It's absolutely brilliant. And what I've found is when it comes on, I can sing all the songs. Yeah. I remember all the songs, but I don't just remember the songs. I remember where I was at the time. So some of the records, and again, I don't want to date myself, from when I was a little girl, it reminds me of dancing around the living room. Yeah. You know, we put it on the record player and I was dancing around the living room. Other things, I think when I was at university, it was the Specials and Madness. They were very, it was a very unique genre. And when that comes on, I'm just completely transported back to university. I'm also, I don't know if you know, but I play violin. I played in a university orchestra since 1990. So I've been playing over 30 years in the university orchestra. So I'm very musical. I play violin, piano. My claim to fame is that I used to play the university church organ. And I did my higher music playing Bach's Toccata and Fugue, you know, the dilly, 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 dilly. And used to go into the church in the evening. So I was 16, 17, into a dark church in the evening. And I'd be in the organ loft and I'd have all the stops out. And there was just blackness behind. I can still remember it because I used to feel frightened going into the church, and I shouldn't have felt frightened. But the power of the church organ. So yes, I'm very musical. It's a very important part of my life. But I have, I suppose, an eclectic taste because I like classical, I like folk music. Some of the classical music I like are various, you know, I played Verdi's Requiem many times, but last year we did the Requiem for the Living, which is Dan Forrest. It's in the Cathedral Concert. That was amazing. It's the most beautiful piece. It's uplifting. Music's a massive part of my life. It's been both my relaxation, it's been a challenge. Over the years, you know, learning new skills. And actually, once you play one or two instruments, you can then learn others. Mm. So I think at last count, I've got about 10 instruments in my study/music room. So I've got piano, I've got four violins. I play mandolin because I used to do a lot of folk music. Again, that's self-taught. Guitar is self-taught. or folk music again. So music is a massive piece of my life, and music speaks to me. So for example, Handel's Messiah, I can't hear that without remembering my mum singing, you know, the altar solo in the church. You know, I know that my Redeemer liveth. I remember her singing in the choir in the Usher Hall in Edinburgh. And we used to go every New Year's Day. And they do Handel's Messiah. So I've sung it. I've played it. And so there are things like that. And in fact, I find it very hard to listen to that without having tears at some point, Chris, because it's something that's been through my life. The other one that always gets me is Nimrod, you know, from the Enigma Variations. And of course, that was at the Cenotaph yesterday morning. That's another one that just I just kind of well up. But yeah, I love music.
Because something that you just maybe think of in there is that when you're creative in one area, that actually you have more, it brings more, it yields more space to do creative things.
Yes.
Because as you say, you play one instrument, there's scope to play another. It opens doors.
Yes.
I mean, I do these interviews, I do this podcast, and I sometimes think, you know, how have I got the time to do all this? But actually, if I didn't do it, then I'd feel that there's something missing. And yes. You're not going to suddenly say, right, I'll do another module spec or whatever. So sometimes there's a place for everything.
Yes.
And sometimes things can be drivers where they come from somewhere else.
Yes.
So the things that I might talk about in the lecture, there might be something in the news that morning that is a perfect analogy for the example I want to use. Or it might be a bit of music, but it might be a different analogy, a different example the next time. So the lecture notes in some ways might stay the same year in, year out, but the lectures are never going to be the same.
No.
Because of everything else that pivots around
it. Yeah, that's interesting. You bring a different perspective to it every time. I mean, one of the things I love is... And I love sometimes when I'm listening to music, I want to be quite analytical with it. So I will listen. So my mum was an alto. So I just know all of the alto parts to all of the Christmas carols. And I almost can't sing anything. I'm a soprano, but I've never forgotten that, because every Christmas, that's, you know, we talked about Christmas earlier. Every Christmas we'd sing in the church choir, and I know all the alto parts off by heart, because that's what I was brought up with. Similarly with Handel's Messiah, I know the alto part as well as I know the soprano part.
No, and on all the way, everything that you're describing here and the enthusiasm with which you're showing it means that although you may have spent many years in one place, that there are things from outside and things that you grew up with that actually infuse and imbued your entire way of being. And which actually, so it's not the case that, you know, hearing you, it's obvious that you were not doing the same thing for all those years.
Yes.
Because there's something there that if you weren't doing it here, you would have been doing it somewhere else. But you were able to incorporate it into here because, you know, through the agency, through the means of the of the concert orchestra.
Yeah. I think the other thing that makes me, you know, it's like, what do you, we talk to our students about extracurricular. What do they do that's extracurricular? And one of the things that I've done for many years is be a school governor. I did that for over 22 years, and that was very interesting in the community. I also managed the ladies' hockey team at Canterbury Hockey Club for a couple of years, because my daughter is a very good hockey player, the younger daughter. And instead of calling me the manager, they used to call me the mummager, because, of course, I was her mother. But and, you know, again, that was fantastic. Every weekend was spent away. It could be as far as Exeter or whatever with the hockey team. I've always described it as a bit of a four-dimensional experience in the dugout, because it's blood, sweat, tears and more. You know, it's a very visceral experience. You know, girls, either they're buoyed up because they're playing well, or they're down because they don't feel they're playing well. And so there's a, you've got to try and I suppose encourage them just to go out and play their best game. So I've done it's the one thing over the years, as I said, there was never the plan to be at Kent for 34 years, and there have been opportunities in those 34 years to move on and go elsewhere. But actually, I think what has stopped that has been, well, number one, the opportunities have arisen here for me to develop and move from being an academic to an administrator and then somewhere in between. as director of education, but also because I was so connected to the community. And so I was always making that comparison. I mean, I would have found the same elsewhere. I know I would have, but it wasn't, for me, it wasn't just about the job. It was the much bigger picture. It was the community I was part of is really important as well.
And that's a perfect segue to my final question, which is whether you'd consider yourself, Louise, to be a looking back or a looking forward type of person.
Okay. I would generally say I'm a looking forward person, but the looking forward is done with a very firm foot looking back. Often people say, you know, well, what would you tell your younger self? You know, and a lot of people say, I wish I hadn't worried about this. And, you know, one of the things, you know, and it's quite a sad thing, but my mum was widowed when I was six. My dad died when I was six of cancer, and he was 39. And that left me with a little bit of a concern throughout my life. It could happen. I could lose my mum, you know. And I remember after my mum's funeral, and I was in the car with my brother, and I remember saying to him, I wish I'd known when I was younger that mum would live till she was 87 and that I didn't have to worry that she was going to go as well. And it's some of that, and there's no doubt. I think as humans, we you know, having a little, you know, we're not really living if we're not feeling a level of, I don't know that anxiety is the right word, but a level of uncertainty. It's that, you know, the only constant is change. There's uncertainty there, but it's about how we deal with that uncertainty. And it's about learning that whatever happens, we will deal with it, because there are things that happen in life that were unexpected or things didn't go as to plan. And you have to learn to deal with it. So I think some of the encouragement, and I'm listening to you talking about your diary, you know, some of the encouragement can come from just reflecting back on, yeah, that was a difficult period. You know, I found I was tidying out a drawer the other day, and when I was meeting up with a friend, I said it was really interesting to see where I was at that time and how I've learnt from that. Yes. So,
well,
so
you're absolutely right. It's that whole thing about negative experiences. Yeah, you know, can you be nostalgic about them? But there is something fundamental there that, in the example I gave earlier, somebody who might be worried about their degree, but then they do well,
yes,
and they look back and think, oh yeah, yeah, it was all fine.
Yes.
But they only got the degree through a lot of anxiety,
exactly,
and that's inbuilt in it. So I'm always wary of somebody who might revisit the past. We all do it for simplistic purposes. It's almost like say you have to categorize that period was good, that period was not so good. But actually it's the without the growth, without the learning from there, then actually it's very hard to mature. It's not actually, and also life takes on a far more sort of stagnant dimension because it's the living on the edge. I mean, it's like a PhD viver where I remember being told afterwards that, oh, yes, they'd already decided the outcome. It was all fine. But I treated it like my life was on the line. And I'm glad I did.
Yes.
Because if I'd gone in complacently and thinking, oh,
you may
you
not
know,
have achieved it.
No. But I didn't know.
And I think this is what we were saying earlier. Actually, sometimes the more challenging bits, what we learn going through that, are real. They are real growth periods. And I think that's important. I suppose the only other thing that I would say is also the importance of accepting that the negative happens and not trying to smooth over, trying to give people space and time to talk about what it means for them, or for somebody to give you the space and time to talk about what it means for you. Not to sort it, but just to be able to open up about it. Because I think very often we're not that good at doing that as humans. We want to sort it, and actually some people don't want it sorted. They just want someone to listen. And I think that's something that it's something that we learn to do over time, and we all do it slightly differently. And I suppose it's a little bit like me being a manager. And I remember there was a change in the way I managed over a period of time. What I had observed was people would come and say, I've got this problem, tell me what to do about it. And over time, I'd say, well, what do you think we should do? So I didn't offer the solution. And then they would say this, and then they would say, but the only bit I can't quite get. And then we talk about that bit. 99% of the time, people have already got the solution. What they need is the affirmation. They need somebody just to listen to what they want to do, but they know what they want. They know what is right to do. So actually, I that is something that I mean, there was not a single switch there. It wasn't an epiphanal moment. It was over time. And of course, that's fabulous for colleagues, because what you're saying is, I trust you to know the answer and you can go and get on with it. So you're allowing them to grow as well. But that importance of listening, and we're maybe not so good at that, and not so good when things are negative, just to give the time and the space that it takes just to deal with that. Because that's the human bit, isn't it? Yeah. Isn't that the human bit?
Yeah, and I think that sometimes it's not a case, as I remember from school sometimes, when, you know, it's the right answer or the wrong answer. You know, if I get the answer wrong, people will laugh at me. Actually, the answer will change depending on the set of circumstances. I'm not talking about a factual six plus six. I don't mean that. But more about the right thing to do, the right decision to take. These things are, there's a combination of advice that we need from people. There's the inner, you know, the trust and confidence and the maturity and the experience of, I was in this position 5 years ago, you know, but I chose that path. Do I take that same path, or actually, you know, do I build on that? And sometimes we know that we might have made the wrong decision, but actually sometimes in life, hopefully there are chances to rebuild. So it's not the case of, you know, I mean, on a superficial level, you know, you might choose between two films, but, you know, hopefully there'll be a chance for you to watch the other one another night, you know, rather than, well, I made my decision and that's it. You know, sometimes in life you say, well, if it really matters to you, that you may not have made the right course. I mean, sometimes even within a job, you may choose a job or not choose a job, but there may be opportunities within that job to try other things that you might have done had you followed a different path. So sometimes it's the multiplicity of it.
I think it's also, and again, this comes with some maturity and confidence. It's also the ability to acknowledge that perhaps you didn't get it right, and you go back to the past and say, actually, I've reflected on that overnight, and I don't think that's the right way to go. Or I'm not sure I gave the right advice. I think I feel a lot more confident to do that. And it's something I've tried to do with my children as they've grown up. You know, if I felt I've got something wrong, I've sort of said to them, yeah, I didn't quite get that right, you know, because I think they've got to know that you don't get it right 100% of the time. So, you know, it's interesting looking back, and, you know, I'll share with you at my retirement do.
Which I had to miss because I was teaching 4 till 6.
Don't worry. But Richard, who's the DVC, said Louise can be summed up in two words. And of course, I was thinking, oh, my gosh.
Not those two.
Not those two. And he said they're passion and compassion. And I thought, do you know what? That was perfect. Because I hope in our discussion today, I think you reflected earlier, you could see the passion coming through when I was talking about my music or my teaching. But the compassion is about the way that you interact with people. And, you know, going back to something I think I said earlier, was about you don't remember the details of the project or the activity or the event, but you do remember how people made you feel, or how what you did in that scenario. So I think, you know, I felt that, yes, I'll take that. Thank you very much. You know, that I did feel that was a good summary overall. And I thought, well, if that's, you know, if that's on my headstone, I'd be happy with that.
And it's really lovely when it chimes. But at the same time, it's something that you hadn't necessarily thought of in quite the same way, that you might have written references for students. You might be assessing staff as a manager. But actually, it just takes somebody else to say, I'm going to sum you up in two words. And you think, gosh, I wasn't expecting that. But then you think, actually, that really is. Yes. I'd rather not say the epitaph, but it can be the word, because we all need that sometimes. And do we? And also the question, do we want to be defined by our job title? So, you know, if my legacy was to say, well, I don't think it would now, but I was thinking of this maybe a decade or two ago, you know, he lectured in theology. Well, that's factually correct. But the idea that that's everything, that is one important part of what I do. Yes. But now I'd like to think that probably there are other ways of designating what we do. Mm. And they may change over time, but which seems to be more reflective of who we are as people.
Yes, absolutely. And so it goes back to something I said earlier. You know, we often don't get the affirmative feedback that we need. We get the negative feedback. We don't get that affirmative feedback. And one of the most heartwarming things is, having retired, reading through emails from colleagues, not just who are currently at Kent or previously at Kent, or cards, it's actually seeing the impact you've had on people. And some of it's very personal. People have, you know, you've had a different impact on people. And that is hugely affirming, you know, at the end of a long career, to think, my goodness, yes, I did make a difference in people's lives. But I've made a difference in a very bespoke way to them. There are overarching features, but there was something I did specifically for them that they really remember. And that's really rewarding, I think.
Yeah, you know? And that's what keeps you going. And
absolutely. It's not what you seek out, but it's what comes back. And maybe we just need to get better at that balance going through people's careers. And not just in careers, but also, you know, I did a lot of mentoring, and that positive affirmation of what's going well. Don't focus on the 10% that is the challenge. Think of, well, you know, 90% of what you're doing is going really well. So let's just acknowledge that. And now we'll deal with the 10%.
Yeah.
And otherwise, what we deal with is, we always deal with the 10%, and we forget that actually, yeah, but all of this other stuff is brilliant.
And then, of course, we're in the territory of wanting to, or thinking we have to emulate somebody else who that 10% in us is 90% in them. Mm-hmm. But they shouldn't be us any more than we should be them. So I think it's having that integrity and authenticity of knowing that actually we can reach maybe the same or a similar destination, but on our terms, because we'll take people with us on that route.
Absolutely.
Well, with passion and compassion, you've been a phenomenal guest. Thank you, Louise, for being my guest this week.
Thank you, Chris. Absolute pleasure.